Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order, 9 a.m., March the 5th. We're in the Senate Finance Committee in Capital City, Juneau, Alaska. Members present, Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, we expect Senator Coughlin shortly. Senator Kronk and Senator Olson is excused till next week. Today's agenda, we have two items on the agenda this morning. First up, we will be hearing from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, known as ASME, and then we'll take up the Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska that we rescheduled from Monday's meeting. So with that, I invite to the table the Executive Director of ASME, Jeremy Woodward. Please identify yourself and continue with your presentation.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Hoffman and members of the Senate Finance Committee. Nice to see you this morning. For the record, my name is Jeremy Woodrow. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Prepared for you today, a brief presentation, about 25 slides. I know we are limited on time, so I'll try to go through this rather quickly. We're going to cover a brief introduction of ASME and our budget. We'll go through our marketing goals and strategy in the U.S. marketplace, and then we'll briefly touch on what's going on in the international market as well. As a refresher, the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute is Alaska's official seafood marketing arm. We established it under statute as a state corporation under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Under statute, our goals are to maximize the value of Alaska's seafood resource. We do this through building and protecting the Alaska seafood brand, developing and creating markets for the Alaska seafood products, and working directly with the Alaska seafood industry. We're directed by a 7-member board of directors that are appointed by the governor. We also have several ex officios of members of the legislature, as well as the executive branch. And then the board has created 9 board-appointed advisory committees made up of additional members of the seafood industry to help advise ASME staff and marketing direction. ASME divides its programs into 5 main verticals. That is international and domestic marketing, seafood technical, communications and public relations, and global food aid. For the main purpose of today's presentation, I'll primarily be covering our domestic marketing program and our international marketing program. A side-by-side look at ASME's current year, fiscal year 2025 budget, and our budget request for fiscal year 2026. You'll note that ASME receives its funding from 3 primary pools. That is our seafood marketing assessment, which is illustrated as statutory designated program receipts. This is paid for by the Alaska seafood industry. This is based on the ex-vessel value. For those that might not be familiar with the term ex-vessel value is that first sale that happens between a fisherman and a processor. Some might call it the dock price. In statute, it gives the industry the ability to actually vote it up, down, or out. So this is a voluntary assessment by the industry to provide for the funding of ASME. Right now, it's set at a half of 1% of that ex-vessel value. You'll notice a difference between 25 and 26, that it goes down by about $3 million. I'll touch on this in other slides, but in summary, the industry right now is suffering to a crisis, and ex-vessel values are down across the board, and therefore ASME's revenues from the industry are also down. And so that's a reflection in that reduction. ASME also receives various different federal funds in any given year. Our 2 primary funding sources, though, through the federal government are through the Market Access Program, or MAP, and the Regional Agricultural Promotion Program. Both of those programs are under the United States Department of Agriculture Foreign Agricultural Service. It's important to note that these federal funds have to be used for overseas marketing. And so you'll see in a latter slide that it's a fairly significant source of funds. However, we can't use those to target any U.S. Consumers. They all have to be used for overseas. And then lastly, from time to time, ASME will receive unrestricted general funds. You know, in 25, that was zeroed out. And there is a budget request in the supplemental budget for $10 million to be used over 3 years. So it's a multi-year request. And I'll talk about that in a latter slide, too, of what ASME is going to do with that money and why we are requesting it. If you were to take ASME's fund sources and break it down across our different programs, you'll note, as I pointed out in the previous slide, look at all those federal funds, makes our international program fairly large in comparison to our other programs. That's because we must use our state funds, whether it be UGF or the SDPR, in our different marketing programs, whether here in the United States or for our other verticals that I explained earlier. Like any other federal fund, they do come with a match. This match for these federal funds is a little different than how you might think of, say, like a transportation match where there's a direct percentage. These are competitive match funds. So we're competing against the U.S. Pork Board, Beef Board, Almonds from California, Citrus from Florida. They're all competing for the same amount of funds. The easiest way to put it is the more skin in the game we're willing to put in or commit, the more likely we are to receive funds from the federal government to do these overseas marketing. So in this, it's about $3 million has been kind of the right size to receive about $4.5 million of market access program funds and another about $4.5 to $8 million of regional agricultural promotion program funds. Here's a little bit of a look back at ASME's budget history and then also projecting forward of where our budget may go into the future depending on our different fund sources. You'll note here in FY25 through FY30, that's just projected funds. That's where we put the multi-year, the $10 million request is put here, but that's not all going to be spent in FY25. We'd expect to spend that over the course of 26 and 27 as well. Perhaps the largest thing to note here is our statutory designated program receipts or our revenue from the industry. You'll note in 24, 25, and 26, we have a dramatic drop. That's an expectation due to those low ex-vessel prices right now. ASME's revenues are going to take a hit. That's where that $10 million request really comes in, is it helps bring that revenue back up and allows ASME to continue its aggressive marketing program that is really started in around fiscal year 23. You'll notice if you look at that teal line, our spend plan has increased since about FY20 and gone up. This has been a response to a lot of different variables in the marketplace. It started with COVID. It picked up with the large sockeye harvest that we saw in 22 and 23. And then, you know, the hits just keep on coming. And so ASME, through our board's direction, has kept its spend plan rather high to address all these different market challenges. If you take a longer look back at ASME's revenue history, you'll note that around 2011 through 2016, ASME did receive a sizable amount of unrestricted general fund. That started to be reduced into FY2017 and then was eliminated by FY19. We went 5 years without any unrestricted general fund. And so you can see that ASME's funding around 2018 to 2019 became rather volatile. It kind of went up and down. And we've been trying to keep a consistent marketing plan through those variable fund cycles and to address all the different marketing concerns. So before I get into really the $10 million budget request, I think it's important for us to take a quick snapshot at the industry and say, okay, why is ASME asking for this $10 million and why is the industry really asking for this $10 million as well? This goes back to 2022 when we had the largest sockeye run ever in Bristol Bay. It's hard to say that it's possible for us to get too much fish, but it came at a really bad time. When we harvested those 40 million sockeye salmon in Bristol Bay in 2022, it came at a time when the market was not ready to take that fish. We had inflation skyrocketing across the United States and really across the globe, and consumers just stopped spending. It came to a halt. That fish sat in inventory, and as it sat in inventory, it became more and more expensive for processors to hold on to it, and pretty much every processor in the state started operating in the red for a couple of years. This then was compounded by Russia invading Ukraine. And Russia, to fund that war, has offloaded their seafood products, which we compete with on nearly every single fish we catch, they catch as well. They've offloaded their products at record low prices across the global markets. It got to a point a couple years ago where a processor couldn't even buy pink salmon because they could not sell that pink salmon at a price on the global market where they could even make a cent. That's how bad it got. I'm happy to say that things have improved a little bit, but we are still reeling from those really tough years in 2022 and 2023. This has then been compounded with, you know, inflation has hit everybody. We've all seen it. It's all hit our pocketbooks, and our industry is not immune to that. And the cost to do business in Alaska has increased dramatically for the seafood industry. And it's taken me 3 years to figure out how to sum it up, but I think the best way to sum it up is right now the cost to execute Alaska's fisheries is not price competitive with our global competition. We need to figure out a better way to execute our fisheries here at home so we're competitive in the marketplace. I will say that the legislature, through a task force, has been working on addressing this. I know there's many bills that are coming out, and House Fisheries is going to be working on these bills. And I commend the legislature for, you know, trying to address this challenge and working on helping the industry in any way that it can so that we can be competitive in the global marketplace. ASME's job is to create value in that marketplace so that our processors and our fishermen can have an easier job doing their jobs, right? And I'll talk about it later, but there's only so much that we can create value on. We still have to be competitive when it comes down to price, and I'll touch that on a later slide. So what are our opportunities? It's not all doom and gloom, and right now we do have an opportunity, and I know there's a lot in the news going on about what may happen to this current opportunity, but right now, you know, to quote Senator Dan Sullivan, we have an opportunity with Freedom Fish, and Freedom Fish being selling Alaska's fish to the United States. By executive order in 2023, President Biden banned the import of Russian seafood into the United States. That became effective in May of 2024. There was a lot of inventory loading of Russian seafood, though, in the United States around that time, during that time period. And to our best guesses, that inventory has probably ran out. And so by law, there should not be any Russian seafood in the U.S., definitely not that was purchased after May of 2024. This provides about a $452 million opportunity for the Alaska seafood industry and left about a 70,000 metric ton hole that had to be, you know, that needs to be filled by other seafood products. This provides opportunity for pink and chum salmon, sablefish, pollock and surimi, as well as our flatfish species, but it really provides opportunity for all of our seafood species in the U.S. marketplace. It's important to note, though, that we aren't the only region, seafood-producing region in the world who's looked at this as an opportunity. Our competitors not named Russia have all publicly identified the U.S. as an opportunity for growth because of this ban. So if you're producing seafood from Norway, Chile, Iceland, or maybe farmed tilapia from Southeast Asia, you're looking at the U.S. as an opportunity to grow your sales as well. So this is not a given to us. We need to compete for this marketplace. And this is what one of ASME's goals are here in the near term. So with that $10 million supplemental budget request, ASME has three primary goals over the course of the next 3 years. The primary one is to capitalize on that Russian seafood ban and increase Alaska seafood sales in the U.S. marketplace. We also need to increase Alaska's brand recognition in the U.S. marketplace in order to do this. This also provides an opportunity for us to differentiate the Alaska Responsible Fisheries Management Program. This is a program that was created by ASME over a decade ago. It's become larger and more accepted in the marketplace. RFM counters the Marine Stewardship Eco-Label, which continues to certify Russian-caught seafood in the global marketplace. RFM is one of the best ways that we can provide confidence to the marketplace and to consumers that this seafood is indeed certified sustainable and also not Russian origin as well, too. Our seafood industry has bought into it, and other regions of the world are also buying into the RFM program as well. If you were to take that $10 million supplemental request and divide it out across ASME's marketing programs in the U.S. marketplace, our intention is to spend the majority of it in our U.S. retail and food service promotions and also amplify our U.S. Consumer public relation program here. And I'll touch on each of these in later slides. But before we do that,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Can we go back to slide 12? So a year ago, we were doing our budgets, and it appeared that we were in a position where we had the opportunity delivered to us to expand our market share by absorbing some of the potential Russian market that they're on the way out. So we, at this table, had the discussion and decided that we would step up to the plate with $10 million to advocate for an aggressive marketing campaign to supplant that Russian product with Alaska product is what we did. the administration had a different opinion and decided they were going to veto that for whatever reason. That didn't make much business sense to me, quite frankly, to watch this opportunity go by. And now we are sitting here with $10 million spread over 3 years with a request in the supplemental budget. And when we look at the supplemental budget, it won't get passed until the budget for FY26 gets passed on the same day, same set of paperwork, sitting on the governor's desk when he signs it. So 25 will be pretty much done. We'll be in 26. So why help the Finance Committee understand this $10 million spread over 3 years with 1 year already gone? We have a deficit issue in 25. Why we don't move this to 26 and make it a two-year appropriation?
I'm going to go back a couple slides. To the chair, Senator Stedman, that's a great question. So going back to slide 7, if we look at ASME's spend plan in this year, and we're about a little over $23 million of our spend plan, if this budget were to pass sooner, and I understand there's a lot of things that happen to get the budget out the door and to get it signed, but if this budget were to pass sooner, ASME could access those funds into this current fiscal year and amplify sales in, say, June. And that would allow us to hit the ground running a little bit faster with our current marketing plan. That is one reason why it was put into the FY25 supplemental. If you look at our projection for FY26 and 27, you'll notice that they're quite a bit higher than what we intend to spend in 28 and 29. This is part of, in due part to that supplemental budget request. So that $10 million would be spread across those subsequent years and allow ASME to keep our spend plan at this record high level, which is around that $21 to $22 million range. If you go back into ASME's history, we haven't had a spend plan this high for really ever. And so we're as aggressive as we ever have been, and this $10 million budget request allows us to continue that aggressive marketing.
Senator Stedman.
I think it's highly unlikely we're going to do a supplemental budget, fast supplemental budget, with the financial challenges we have at the table. So it's going to be wrapped into the final budget numbers, documents. We'll have the supplemental for 25, the 26 budget, all in one big package with a pretty bow on it when we're done. And that hopefully will be in the middle of May. It may be the end of June. But in any event, it's rare that the governor signs a budget very quickly when we hand it to him. She normally signed a budget a week out or so from the July 1st deadline. So FY25 is essence come and gone. So we need to look forward with ASME on how we're going to try to save or penetrate as much of this market opportunity in the states as possible, if it's even still available, because it's unlikely that Chile and Norway is going to wait around for Alaska to get through its political macerations to make a decision to grab that market share. So anyway, Mr. Chairman, I just like to point that out, that we may want to consider adjusting the time frame here to really the FY26, FY27, and if they want a three-year appropriation, make it FY28. Thereby not increasing the dollar amount, but massaging it somewhat more effectively for ASME's benefit, and the benefit, frankly, of the industry that is losing processing capacity due to financial insolvency and mergers. So we've got, an issue, an underlying issue that affects 44,000 Alaskans roughly. And this is a big part of the solution, in my opinion, Mr. Chairman.
I totally agree with that. And I think we should give serious consideration to making that appropriation for 2 years. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a food for thought question for the table. Things changing with Russia. quickly. What if we find ourselves marketing Freedom Fish and suddenly that doesn't have the same fine marketing point that it might have had if things with the Russian situation change rapidly and somehow we kind of move along from the Ukrainian situation that drove, you know, that political issues around the marketplace. So a couple things could happen. We lose that marketing angle on the fish, but we also perhaps end up with an influx of oil production should the Russian oil production come in. So we're hit with prices for oil being pushed downward, and also we put money into a marketing plan that might not, if it's not carefully devised, might not be nimble enough to actually market in a changing world. Just thank you.
Thank you.
Please proceed. Yeah, to the chair. Senator Coffin, that's a great point you made, and I'm going to touch on that right now. I might talk a little bit about Russia and what might happen in trade in a later slide. I do have a slide that talks about trade, but I will say that if that ban were to be lifted, it would create a lot of turmoil for the Alaska seafood industry because of the ability to compete with those low prices. And the reason why I say that ability to compete with those low prices, we look at this slide right here, and the number one driving factor to purchasing seafood for consumers in the U.S. is price, right? And so we know that ASME can provide a premium, and we have done a good job of providing a premium for our Alaska seafood products, but consumers are only willing to come up so much on price because it's how all of us shop. That's not a surprise there. What's great, though, is that when you're purchasing seafood, majority of consumers, the next claim that's the most important to them is wild-caught. And matter of fact, 53% of seafood buyers prefer wild-caught seafood, and only 12%, or what is it, 15% preferred farmed. So that's a fairly wide range, and it gives us opportunity in the U.S. marketplace. What's also an opportunity we see here, too, is that we know consumers want to eat more fish. This is for not only just because it's good for the planet, but it's also good for their health, and people have identified health as a major driving factor of why they eat seafood. And so that's another area that Alaska seafood can capitalize on. When we take this research and we drill it down a little bit further into the Alaska seafood brand, this puts us even in a better position to compete with products like Russia. Now, why we might not be compete with them on price one for one, we do have a great brand recognition, and this is where ASME has done a great job of building that value for the Alaska seafood industry. When Alaska is called out on packaging, and better yet, when the Alaska seafood label is used on packaging, consumers say that they are willing to pay more. Matter of fact, 78% of consumers say that they're willing to pay more for that product because it has the Alaska seafood logo. So we've created this value proposition for consumers. We just need to make sure that our products can compete with that value proposition, right? We can't ask 30% more. We might be able to ask 10% more. But that's that challenge that we have going on here in Alaska is how do we create those products at a price competitive point where we can ask that little bit more that we've created for consumers. So how are we going to target consumers, really, here in the United States? Well, one of our first steps is we work with our public relations program, and this is how we tell that story, that Alaska seafood story and that Alaska story to consumers through channels that they trust and through voices that they trust as well. We work with influencers, celebrity chefs such as Martha Stewart or maybe Top Chef winner Melissa King. We work on their social media. We might pay them to be influencers on social media to connect with their audiences. This is probably the best way to really tell that in-depth story about Alaska seafood and really connect consumers to our brand. We'll then take that, and we'll take that same messaging and drive it through our retail promotions. This is just one example with Costco. We work with all major retailers across the United States and really across the world. When we're working with retailers, we're really trying to attack an omni-channel approach. That's why I use this Costco here as an example. It's because this is a perfect example. This is what we did during the sockeye boom, you could say it a couple years ago. But here's an example of how we took the same product and featured it four different ways in four different mediums through the Costco atmosphere, whether it was a video on their online sites, advertising it through their Costco Connection magazine ad, which goes to every single Costco cardholder, showing videos about Alaska sockeye salmon and warehouses on those big screen TVs that you see when you walk in, and then also touching it on their cell phones to their in-house catalog. All these different touch points lead to a stronger path to purchase. So when that consumer walks into the grocery store, they don't have to think twice. They've already have the confidence in buying these Alaska seafood products. This isn't the only way that will work in retail as well. We're also working in the various different digital mediums. We work with Chicory. Chicory is a direct-to-online cart app that you can plug into recipes online, whether it be on the Alaska Seafood website or on other websites, say if an influencer has their own blog where they're creating recipes. If a consumer's reading that recipe and say, hey, that looks delicious, I want to cook that tonight, you can see that Shop Now button. You click Shop Now, it adds to your digital cart all the ingredients you need to purchase that product. If you live in an area where you can have that then delivered to your door, all those ingredients will be delivered to your door later that day, or you can have it where you can pick up from your favorite grocery store. This has been incredibly successful for us. We saw over $2.4 million in sales just through our Chicory campaign. Our click-through rate is higher than the industry average as well when we're advertising Alaska Seafood. We also partner with Ibotta. Ibotta is a digital coupon app that's on your phone. What's great about Ibotta is this allows us to bring in all the Alaska Seafood products that are out there in the retail space. We capture all those different UPC codes, and through a dollar off campaign, we can really target new consumers and bring them into the Alaska Seafood category. I won't go through the in and outs of how Ibotta works, but what I can say is one of the best parts about Ibotta is, if you look at that last bullet in the gray there, is it 26% new followers came into the seafood category, into the Alaska seafood category. And probably the best part is after the campaign ended, they went back to the grocery store and on average bought Alaska seafood 2.65 times more. So these are new people to the category buying more seafood than they've ever bought before because we've brought them into the space with just a little bit of a discount for this app. Great return on investment. Moved a lot of units daily through this program, and this is something that we'll continue to do to continue to bring in new consumers. Last piece on retail here. This is probably my favorite slide of this whole presentation I'm going to give you. Sushi has been booming at retail. Not only has sushi been booming, this is the fastest growing seafood category in the fastest growing place within the retail space, and that's the deli section. Sushi is growing, outpacing every single other category in seafood. The best part about sushi at retail, too, is that one of our largest species is predominantly featured, and that's Alaska surimi made with wild Alaska pollock. That's in every single California roll that everybody loves to eat. So we decided to capitalize on this growing trend. We partnered with Fujisan Sushi, which is in every single Sam's Club location across the U.S. And we decided also to lean into that selling Alaska through an Alaska Cruise sweepstakes. You can see the interest of leaning into Alaska three different ways here, through Alaska Sushi, Alaska Seafood, and Alaska Cruise, is that consumers really responded to this. We had over 60,000 entries in 30 days. That's incredible. What was also great about this promotion was that the other sushi purveyors across the U.S. started calling us and say, hey, this was awesome. We want to do this as well. And so you'll see a lot more sushi programs coming out of Alaska Seafood in the coming year because this program really was successful. Lent just started, and that means you're going to see a lot of crispy, delicious whitefish at QSR or quick service restaurants or fast food restaurants, as most of us call them. What's most exciting about fast food in the last couple years is it's not just Alaska pollock that's featured. We now have Alaska flounder or sole, depending on which coast you're on of the U.S., that's also being featured in fast food restaurants. It's great to see that we've been able to expand this category and expand offerings to our customers throughout this time. Why is Lent so important? Just to throw out a quick fact for you, McDonald's sells a quarter of all of its fillet of fishes through this 40-day period in the year. So there's a lot of seafood that's moved through Lent. It's a great opportunity for us to tell that Alaska seafood story, get that Alaska seafood logo out there, and get it in the face of more consumers throughout the year. Of course, we're always working on lasting promotions. When we partner with these major brands, and we might give them a little promotional dollars to feature our seafood products to elevate those before their consumers, what we're really trying to do is to show them that Alaska seafood message sells. And so that when they come back to us, they're not coming back to us because we have dollars to give to them. They're coming back to us because they know that the Alaska seafood message can move products and it can really drive sales for them. And so we might actually reduce our amount that we partner with them year after year because they know that there's a great value in just selling Alaska. And that's really what we're trying to do with all of our promotional partners. The best part about the Alaska seafood product portfolio is that we have products that can reach every single every single restaurant in the U.S. We have high-end products that can be in your fanciest white tablecloth restaurants. Then we also have those value-added products that can be in your fast food restaurants. The unsung hero in getting into every single restaurant space in the United States is through our distributor promotions. The distributors, that's the menu that chefs and restaurant purveyors order off of. And so when we work with distributors to highlight Alaska seafood products to their customers, that gets Alaska seafood into more restaurants and more locations across the United States. Our distributor promotions have been extremely successful for ASME in the last few years, and we continue to capitalize on that. As you can see in fiscal year 24, our distributor promotions were able to drive over $120 million in sales. For every dollar that we spent on a distributor promotion, over $616 of Alaska seafood was sold to that promotion. That's a great return on investment, one area that we'll continue to capitalize on.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we go to the next slide, could you talk to us a little bit about any marketing opportunities or market penetration with the cruise ships that come to Alaska and the cruise industry? There seem to be a captive lot of folks sitting on those ships eating farm fish for God only knows why.
Yep. To the chair, Senator Stedman, we have increased our cruise promotions in the last several years. You're right, that is a great audience, and it's a captive audience that's coming to the state, and it's an audience that's increasing year over year as well. There is a challenge with selling Alaska seafood to our cruise ship partners. One of that is price point. They command or demand a very low price point that, frankly, that I think a lot of our Alaska seafood businesses prefer not to come down to be able to sell at the volumes that they want to purchase. There are higher-end restaurants and a lot of the cruise ships that will carry Alaska seafood products to sell to their customers. And so we've worked with Holland America and Princess to tell the Alaska seafood story in the place that Alaska seafood products are. We've actually put cruise ship ambassadors where we'll take either fishermen or members of the processing community, and they'll be on the cruise ships and they'll give presentations while at sea to customers while they're on board and tell them where they can find Alaska seafood, whether it's when they step offshore in Alaska or when they go home as well, too. So we are trying to tell that story and do a better job telling that story to those customers when they're in Alaska.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
So switching gears a little bit, let's talk about the international market. And why is the international market really important? Well, I've talked about what we're going to do in the domestic market and our opportunity there. But in any given year, anywhere from 65 to 70% of Alaska seafood product is exported internationally. The best way to think of which products go overseas is a lot of our higher volume, lower value products, such as Alaska pollock, pink salmon, chum salmon, those are going to go overseas to be reprocessed and then exported to other regions of the world. A lot of our higher value, lower volume products, such as Alaska king salmon, king crab, or halibut, most of that stays here in the United States. Now, there are some products that span both spectrums. Think of like Alaska sockeye salmon. That's a premium product. That's also a high-volume product. You're going to find sockeye salmon in nearly every corner of the world. That, you know, the one silver lining of that 2022 year was that sockeye salmon made a name for itself. We bought a lot of shelf space across the world, and consumers recognize it. For all of my life, we've been trying to convince consumers that there are five species of salmon, actually six if you add Atlantic in there. Right now, they know that there's wild, farmed, and sockeye. So we've made progress, and that was because of that giant peck. Consumers look for it. It's bright red, and it has bought shelf space. That's great. And now it's across the world. And so we've created a premium around Alaska sockeye salmon. It's now time to lift that up a little bit more, especially compared to our farm competitors. If you look at this map here, the best way to summarize it is those blue dots are where ASME has active marketing programs. Those red dots are where ASME does not have active marketing programs. The biggest outlier here is South Korea. You might go, well, why is that a big red dot and we're not there? South Korea is mainly a cold storage pass-through region. So a lot of seafood products will go to South Korea, hold in cold storage, and then get re-exported to, say, Japan, China, Southeast Asia, where it's then further processed, or may go directly to that final market, such as Europe. And so a little bit of Alaska seafood product actually enters South Korea, but not as much as, when I say South Korea, the South Korean domestic market, but not as much as that red dot would assume. When you look at trends of exports, though, this is probably the biggest shift we've seen. And when you look at China, and you look back on that last line, you go, okay, China was a little under $600 million in exports. Well, if you go back to 2017, 2018, China represented about $1 billion of Alaska seafood exports. And you see now that's down to a little over $500,000. So you'll go, okay, well, where did that other half a million dollars go? Where did it shift? A little bit of that might be here in the United States. But really, there is no one replacement for China. And so you look at this change here, and it really has been absorbed in a few different regions. Other might include South America, Latin America, might include parts of the Middle East, maybe even India. Those are areas we're seeing growth of Alaska seafood exports. You'll notice that Southeast Asia has grown considerably over the last several years, as well as Europe has kind of come up and stabilized around that 26%. So Europe's become a larger trading partner for Alaska seafood. The reason why China really dropped off is because we entered a trade war with them in 2018. And we lost that market, that domestic market, nearly overnight. That other $500 million, that was probably going into the Chinese domestic market. We've now lost those consumers, and that's been replaced by Russian product. And I'll talk about more how trade impacts where our products go in a latter slide.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. So, Mr. Woodrow, this and the previous slide are where the fish first hit after it left Alaska. How should we understand the relationship to where the fish is ultimately consumed?
That's a great question. That, I think, is better captured when you look at this map here and look at, okay, these are those large halos. And so our largest consumer markets are Europe and Japan. We're growing Southeast Asia, and we're growing South America. The UK would be included in Europe as well as large consumer markets.
Okay, that's helpful.
Yep.
Thank you.
That's a great question.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
So when you look at this slide here and go, okay, our exports are changing, where does ASME come into play? Well, ASME's job is to be that front lines and go out there and find those new markets to help the industry be nimble and be able to move their products where we have opportunities. And I'm going to use Southeast Asia here as a case study. We started the Southeast Asia program, and this was through federal dollars, through the market access program that I mentioned earlier. We started this program in 2019, and in a short period of 4 years, we saw our sales increase by $40 million into Southeast Asia. That's part and due to trying to find a market outside of China and find other areas, but also grow that domestic market. To see $40 million in sales increase for only about $1.5 million of expenses from, you know, ASME's side as well as that, for those federal dollars, that's a fairly good return on investment for our industry. We're also continuing to see consistent growth for species such as flatfish, which have been struggling in the marketplace due to various different reasons. So ASME's job is to go out there and find these new markets and help our industry find those relationships, find those new processors, find those new consumers who are going to want to carry Alaska seafood products and bring our Alaska seafood companies along. We're doing this right now also in North Africa and Middle East. We're trying to expand Eastern Europe as well, though that's have challenges due to the war in Ukraine. But there's other pockets around the world that ASME is looking at to try to diversify our portfolio and try to move more of that away from China because China's become such a complicated marketplace. All right, there's been a lot going on in trade and tariffs in the news, so it would be remiss to talk about what's going on in the global marketplace without talking about how trade impacts our ability to do business in the marketplace. I've tried to summarize this in one slide, though I will admit that this is very difficult. This could be another 45-minute presentation if we wanted to. The simplest way to put it is we compete against many different products and many different countries in every single marketplace that we export to. And generally, the U.S. seafood products face higher tariff rates in our global markets than our competitors do. So we have a more difficult entry into that marketplace to start with. When the U.S. is in negotiations with a lot of our different trade partners around the world, U.S. seafood is a fairly small piece of our exports, especially when you put us next to like soybeans or technology or cars or beef or pork. So we're often collateral damage. We're not the bargaining chip. We're often lumped into other trade negotiations. So that impacts us as well, too. And then we'll have to point out as well, we talked about Russia a lot. Where Russia's banned from the U.S., they aren't outright banned anywhere else in the world. So we are still competing with them. Even if they might have higher tariffs to enter some marketplaces, we're still competing against them. This chart I have here is just one example of how complex this is. This just shows how we compete in the United Kingdom. You could create a similar chart for nearly every single marketplace we do business. You'll notice, though, that the U.S. has no preferential access into the U.K. The U.K. is a major trading partner for the United States. However, you'll notice that a lot of our competitors, they have either reduced tariffs, they have preferential access, they might have a trade agreement that's actually put in place to provide access. We do not have that same access. So we are entering their market at the rates that they've created that any of other countries might have preferential access to. This is the same in the EU. This is the same in China. This is the same in Japan. This list goes on and on and on. So when we're asked to sell our product at, say, 10% or 14% higher than our competitors, we're now coming into that marketplace and asking those consumers to pay that much more for our product. So it makes it a challenge. When these negotiations shift dramatically, it makes that challenge even more challenging because now we're having to be nimble and move to yet another marketplace or move out of a market such as China, for instance. We've moved out of China and we've had to now find other marketplaces to do our business. What our industry needs more than anything is stability so we can tackle a market and stay in that market and build that consumer demand, build that customer preference. When we're moving around a lot, it costs us a lot of money, it costs us a lot of time, and it puts us behind our competitors who have these trade negotiations in place and have stability in these export markets. So, to summarize real quick, I know I've covered a lot in this presentation. ASME's near-term goals, though, really are the U.S. marketplace. While we are doing a lot in the international market, our near-term goals are the U.S. marketplace. We need to capitalize on that Russia ban as long as it stays in place. We need to increase the seafood brand recognition and grow the RFM recognition in the U.S. marketplace as well. And that concludes my presentation.
Jeremy, can you give the committee an idea of comparison of what Alaska spends on marketing compared to other major countries that spend their funds on marketing?
Certainly. To the chair, that's a great question. Our biggest competitor and probably our most, you could say, equal comparative as far as a marketing agency would be the Norwegian Seafood Council. They have global budgets of, I believe it's last I saw was around 50 to 55 million. They've dedicated of that 5 million to the U.S. marketplace. That's about the size of our U.S. marketing spend. And they, of course, are a global brand that you've probably recognized. There are others. It's been tough for me to find what Canada spends, but I will say, as I've gone to different trade shows, that Canada has put a significant amount of resources behind their Canadian seafood brand in the last few years, and to a point where I expect that their budget is equal or larger than ours as well.
Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be remiss to say, because I doubt I have one constituent in my Senate district that would want $1 of Alaska money to be spent to advertise pollock or streaming projects because of how it's caught. And trawling is billions of dollar industry. I'm pretty sure they can market their own stuff, but I just want to put that on the record because we are facing, you know, we can't even subsistence fish in some of our rivers because of the returns. And I just want to put that on the record. I doubt I have a single constituent that would want to see any state dollar marketing more pollock or surimi products. They're a billion-dollar industry. I think they can advertise for themselves. But thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Jeremy? Any closing comments?
No, but I appreciate the support. Thank you so much for letting me be here today. And if there's any questions, please reach out.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was a very well presented presentation. The second item on our agenda today is the Medicaid Enrollment and Spending in Alaska, known as MESA report. So please come forward, Ted Colvoit, the healthcare economist for Evergreen Economics. Please identify yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Helvoit. I'm president of Evergreen Economics. And we're going to talk about Medicaid today. Ostensibly, this is about the forecast, 20-year forecast, but we're also going to talk a lot about what's happened in Medicaid, a few slides over what's happened over Medicaid over the last 20 years, how we got here, as well as what's happened the last few years in Medicaid. And these are kind of important points to kind of think about what's happening in the future. And we checked the slide deck, and it's going to work this time. So let's do it. I think everyone here knows, because I've done this presentation, I think, to everybody at the table. The legislature in 2005 requested that a long-term forecast be done for Alaska and to be updated on an annual basis. And the impetus of that was that spending on Medicaid program was increasing rapidly 2002, 2003, 2004 by about 15% per year. At that same time, the Medicaid population really wasn't growing. So spending was going way up, but not the the number of individuals covered by Medicaid. Another important point is the forecast, every one of these forecasts focuses on the Medicaid program as it exists today. There's not speculation about changes in the future. So in every forecast before 2016, there wasn't speculation about, oh, there might be Medicaid expansion in 2016 or such. So it's based on the program as it exists today. And that's important because every time something does come up, every initiative for a change in the Medicaid program, to understand what the impact is going to be on Alaska, you need to know what the baseline is. And so it essentially provides us a baseline. Start the presentation with three of my favorite slides, and this is about bending the Medicaid cost curve. And there's three slides. The first slide is going to focus on spending, and in each of these slides, the green line represents what actually happened, the actual total spending on the Medicaid program, going from fiscal year 1998 through 2024. The blue dotted line represents the original forecast that was presented to the legislature in 2006, and then the blue dashed line represents the current forecast. And the big takeaway on this is that based on what was happening in the program, the forecast was for significant growth in the Medicaid spending through 2025. And in 2024 alone, the actual spending was about $1.5 billion less than that. And most of that reason it's much lower is actions taken by the department to bend that cost curve. And I don't know all the different things that the department did, but one of the big ones that did happen right away was a big driver of spending was the personal care attendant program within the program, and making change to that service so that to reduce costs over time. So first off, that one's spending. So let's go to recipients of Medicaid. So again, green represents actual, blue dot represents that original forecast, and the blue dash represents the current forecast. The forecast and actuals were very close through 2015, and then diverged greatly due to Medicaid expansion and also some of the other ACA actions, but mostly through expansion, and so that we have a lot more recipients in Medicaid than we would have had without the expansion. The Medicaid recipients peaked in 2022, dropped slightly in 2023 and 2024, and so that's not to say enrollment in Medicaid, but just the individuals that receive Medicaid services. So I'll talk about recipients and I'll talk about enrollees. A recipient is a Medicaid enrollee who receives services. So many, many more recipients today than expected back 20 years ago. So the third slide. So we first talked about total spending, much lower than we expected, recipients much higher than we expected. And so what's really important here, and this has been a big driver of the success of the program over the last 20 years, is spending per recipient has been much lower than expected. And so, again, back when we did this first forecast, we weren't expecting great growth in the Medicaid population. We're expecting great growth in the spending per recipient there, and that has not happened. And so you can see from roughly 2009 through 2021, 22, spending per recipient was flat. That changed in 2020, from 2022 through 2024, that's changed quite a bit. And we'll talk about that a lot today, about why that happened. Okay, we're going to switch gears a little bit into recent trends and events in the program. And so in this first slide, this is to kind of tee up the impact of COVID. And my hope is that this is the last presentation where I talk about COVID. It is important to look at this. And the big takeaway for me on COVID is COVID had very little impact on the program, and it has virtually no impact on the future of the program. So it isn't there's a lot of interest at the time was how is COVID going to affect the long-term spending and enrollment and such in the program, and it's been very little. So the let's just focus on that top colorful line. So the blue represents Medicaid enrollees, so individuals just enrolled in the program before the COVID emergency declaration. So through February 2020, the orange represents the COVID period, so from the emergency declaration until the end of the continuous enrollment mandate by the federal government. So just a reminder, during the COVID emergency, which extended through into April until April 1st, 2023, the federal government required that all states not disenroll anyone on Medicaid unless they explicitly opt out, they move out of state, or they die. And so over that period, Medicaid enrollment increased by about 40,000 people. Since then, during the Medicaid unwinding or the redetermination period, there's about 18,000 people have come off the Medicaid rolls. And so, again, that's enrollment. The lower, very jagged black line represents the recipients month to month. And part of that month-to-month variation has to do with this is based on month of payment, and some months have five Wednesdays, that's the check write day, and some months have four. So there's always going to be variation month to month, but there's also just natural variation in the number of recipients. And so, but basically, the number of recipients have been flat. The number of recipients month to month is much lower than the number of enrollees in that given month. And so, even as Medicaid enrollment increased a lot during COVID and has since started to decrease, that has not affected spending. Has not affected the number of recipients in Medicaid. And let's talk a little bit more about that. Looking at a little bit tighter period for fiscal year 2023, 2024, and the first half of 2025, so through December of 2024, this is total spending on a monthly basis. The blue line represents the total amount of payments made during that month, and the orange line below represents the amount of payments for claims that were received in that current month or one prior month, so the most recent claims. And the big takeaway is, even with the end of the continuous enrollment, spending on the Medicaid program continued to rise. So, and this is total spending. And for going to general fund spending, it's a lower dollar amount, but that increase is even greater, and this is due to, with the end of continuous enrollment, that 6.2 percentage points of federal match, so the federal financial participation was reduced back down to zero. So the regular FMAP is back to what it would have been without that additional support from the federal government. And so even with the end of the continuous enrollment, many fewer people on Medicaid again, spending is still going up. So those two were on spending. Looking at and the number of recipients month to month, this has been flat. So even as the number of enrollees, again, I want to make this point quite a bit, is that enrollment in Medicaid is not the same thing as recipients of Medicaid. So even as the individuals have come off of Medicaid, the number of people receiving services in Medicaid has been basically flat over time. So month on a month-to-month basis. So in other words, folks are still getting the services. And finally, in this kind of set of slides, that what has happened is the amount of spending per recipient is what's going up. And so just in the last two fiscal years, spending per recipient just on that average month-to-month basis has increased by about 8.7% per year. So quite a bit of an increase there. We're going to talk a bunch more about this. Almost all of this has to do with reimbursement rates to providers, which are starting to go up again. So, okay, so this is, I feel, maybe the most important graph about Alaska's Medicaid program. Provides most information in a snapshot about recipients, enrollees, and spending. So in this chart, the blue or the bars represent spending, and the two lines represent the green dashed line represents Medicaid enrollees, and the dark green dotted line represents Medicaid recipients. And so let's focus on the lines first. And starting in fiscal year 2012, the lines were a lot lower, number one, but they're also a lot closer together. So 13 years ago, the number of enrollees and the number of recipients in the program were much closer together than they are today. So, or put another way, most enrollees were also recipients. And as we move through time, and I don't know why all the factors are for this, but as we move through time, well, I do know why the lines went up as Medicaid expansion, but that separation between who is utilizing services and who's just enrolled has increased quite a bit. And so that in fiscal year 2024, less than 7 out of 10 Medicaid enrollees even use services. And my speculation, I don't know this, my speculation is that especially during the period of continuous enrollment, that there's many people that didn't even know they're on Medicaid. So it's that's the extent that it got to. But again, the purpose that I want to put here, the very important one here, is that there's a lot of people who are on Medicaid, even today, who are not using the services. And it's not the enrollees who's enrolled in Medicaid that matters. It's who's receiving services and the high utilizers and such. We'll get to that also. And then the bars. So the blue bars represent state spending. The gray represents the federal portion. And if we go back to 2012, it was roughly 35 to 40% of spending was by the feds, and the remainder by the 35 to 40% was general fund, and the remainder was the feds. And then over time, that has stayed really constant until 2024, and it's bumped up more. But proportionately, the federal government spends much more on the program than the state does. And so this is a combination of Medicaid expansion, added a lot of people onto Medicaid, added both enrollees and recipients. That's most of that money is paid for by, the services are paid for by the federal government. But in addition, the efforts by the department to for IHS reclaiming. And so many of those services that would have been received by an IHS-eligible individual that may have been in the past received regular FMAP, essentially 50 to 51% federal match, are being paid at 100% federal match. And so it has definitely benefited the state by keeping, even as the program has risen quite a bit or grown quite a bit, keeping state spending low.
So under the Trump administration, do you expect, what do you anticipate the federal spending to be in Medicaid?
So through the chair, it's expect. I think that's kind of a fool's game a little bit. But I do think something will happen somewhere. I think the greatest risk for Alaska and for every other state that's expanded, I think the biggest risk to Medicaid is what's going to happen to the federal match for the expansion population. And so, for instance, in Alaska, the expansion population includes that 90% for non-IHS eligible individuals and 100% for IHS eligible individuals. So regardless what happens at FMAP, those that are IHS eligible within the expansion population would still be 100%. But for fiscal year 2025, approximately $460 million will be spent for services for the non-IHS, so the expansion population is not IHS. So, and 10% of that is $46 million. That's what the state would spend. If that goes down from 90% FMAP to 89% FMAP, that's $4.6 million that moves from the feds to the state. Or if it went down 10%, that's $46 million that goes from federal to state. So it's the I'm not sure what's going to happen. You know, this is the to me that's the lowest hanging fruit for the federal government. There may be changes in funding formulas. There's a lot of talk about a per capita allotment to states and such. But I think those are much bigger changes. I think the greatest risk definitely is the expansion, Medicaid expansion. So,
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hovoid, it's a fascinating dynamic with enrollees up, but recipients of Medicaid paid for care flat and costs rising. You offered one possibility that people may not know they have Medicaid care. Is that likely leading us to a situation where people who could get primary and preventive care aren't, and we're ending up paying for more expensive care? Or am I projecting too many possibilities onto the data in front of us?
So, Senator Keel, through the chair, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, there's Alaska is physically a very large state, and the access there's clearly the ability to access care is going to differ across the state. So I don't know the extent that is going to affect access. It's likely. Again, I don't know this, but to me, it's likely that individuals that are enrolled in Medicaid, maybe enrolled in other health care also, health plans, that they were on Medicaid from a job loss or such, then they got a new job, they got new insurance, but they haven't been taken off the Medicaid roll. So there's a lot of different options, a lot of different reasons I think that could be out there. And this same type of phenomenon, I don't have data for other states, but this is happening in other states also. Where the aspects of the ACA and such, essentially people are enrolled in Medicaid, as part of also getting, being on food stamps or TANF or such. So.
Senator Keel?
We'll keep looking. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Yep. Please proceed.
Right. Okay, so switching gears a little bit, a comparison to other states, and these are data from Kaiser Family Foundation. And the years for that, the data were available were 2016 and 2023. And I just included states that I'm regarding as peer states to Alaska. So large states, relatively large states with relatively small populations. And so I have Idaho, Montana, New Mexico, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. And there's three sets of bars here. So one is total spending, growth in total spending by each of those states. Growth in state spending by each of those states, and then growth in enrollment for each of those states. And in all these states, on average, they're all increasing their spending, average annual spending between 2016 and 2023. And Alaska was pretty much right in the middle there. So some states increased spending more than Alaska, some less. But most importantly, to this body, is that state spending, growth in state spending, only Alaska actually reduced their had a percent reduction in average annual spending per year, and that would be largely driven by the IHS reclaiming efforts by the department, and to a certain extent just the Medicaid expansion also, and especially that component of Medicaid expansion that was IHS. So that those individuals that are IHS eligible but were not Medicaid eligible, that they're in the Medicaid program now. And then finally, only Montana had a greater growth in the number of individuals enrolled. And this is the Kaiser data only presents enrollees, not recipients. So this is enrolled only over that period of time. And so when considering other similar states as far as being large and being lower population, Alaska's done well. The Medicaid program has done very well. All right. So I don't talk a whole lot about this figure, but just it provides a bit of a comparison between, or a bit of, yeah, comparison, I guess, between the private insurance enrollment, and that would include through your workplace enrollment, and the Medicaid program for Alaska. And the data available here only go through for the Medicaid data go through 2024, but the private insurance data only go through 2020, and so those are my estimates for 2021, 22, 23, 24. And the over that period of time, this in this case, the bars represent individuals, so enrollment, and the lines, the dashed line and the dotted line represent spending per enrollee. And let's talk about the bars first. The for private insurance, it's been flat in Alaska, flat or slightly declining over the last since 2005, and so at about a little over half the population. While the Medicaid population has increased quite a bit between 2005 and 2023, and the big difference here is there's many fewer individuals in Alaska who are uninsured, and so so on the enrollment side on the with part of the spending, this is the two lines represent spending per enrollee, and again this is per enrollee as opposed to per recipient. That's from the well, the data that were available from the feds there. So, but the takeaway here is the dashed lines representing private insurance that's grown over time, and the dashed line, or excuse me, the dotted line, excuse me, the I said backwards. The dashed line represents Medicaid spending per enrollee, and the dotted line represents private insurance spending per enrollee. And so, those have largely come together over this period of time. In part, that is due to the increase in enrollment in Alaska Medicaid program, but a much larger increase in Alaska Medicaid population than in the recipients in Alaska. So, okay, so let's talk about the projection. And the two big takeaways for the Alaska Medicaid program. The first one is population, and this one affects the Medicaid population a lot, but this also affects Alaska a lot, the economy, and essentially the economy that's going to pay for Alaska Medicaid program in the future. And this are based on the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's forecast, and their projection is that Alaska's population is going to shrink between 2024 and 2044. And so in Alaska's population has shrunk a little bit over the past 5 or 6 years. And so that's a big deal. So for Alaska overall, more importantly, quite honestly, is that the forecast is for the number of children in Alaska to shrink by about 0.5% per year. And so if you're children in Alaska 20 years from now than today, for working age adults to be, working adult being 20 to 64 in this case, being essentially flat, and then for the senior population to increase. And so just on average, seniors are more expensive to cover than children. And so that cohort of the population that's the most expensive to cover is gonna grow much faster than the overall population, which is actually, again, projected to shrink slightly. So number one big driver on the Medicaid and the state overall. Number two is the cost to providers. And so this graph shows for fiscal year 2017 through 2024, the green bars are medical price inflation, and medical price inflation is focused on the private sector, and it's the component of the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. So, and medical price inflation covers private insurance costs, out of pocket for copays and deductibles. So anything an individual with private insurance pays for their health care. That's the green bars. And the gray bars are my estimates of the growth in reimbursement rates to providers. And so, and before we kind of look at these years, if we went back another 10 years, they would look very similar to the 2017 and 2018 bars, where medical price inflation was very high and growth in reimbursement rates to providers was very low. And so that is great for the Medicaid program, keeps costs low. It's not great for providers, and it's not great for private insurance, which are often picking up the what's not paid for with Medicaid. So between 2017 and 2020, on average, each year, medical price inflation, what private insurance is paying, increased by 3.6% per year faster than Medicaid reimbursement rates. Since then, Medicaid reimbursement rates have grown a bit faster than medical price inflation. And so, and put another way, essentially the department could not hold those costs down any further. And so, and this has been a big cost driver for the program over the last few years. And in my projections, this is going to continue to be a big cost driver. The providers are going to want to be paid. And so I don't think it's going to rise as great as fast as medical price inflation, but it's going to grow much faster. It's continued to grow much faster than it has historically through the 2010s and such. So, okay, so let's look at the actual forecast. So over the next 20 years, my expectation is that spending will grow on average by 4.7% per year. It'll be a little faster for the feds. Now that the Medicaid unwinding or the continuous enrollment is over and the that shifting back to the states of that additional FMAP is done, there's going to be, the state will continue to benefit in two ways. One is the ongoing IHS reclaimant efforts by the department will continue to result in more FMAP or more federal funding, number one. Number two, population change. And so the number of individuals in Alaska that are IHS eligible is going to continue to increase. And so that is, proportionally more potential for more federal funding versus state funding. And so while it's going to grow by 4.7, well, my projection is 4.7% overall, it's 4.5%, a little bit lower for general fund spending. Nevertheless, in 2025, total spending on services is going to be a little under $3 billion. By 2045, it'll be around a little bit above $7 billion, so $7.4 billion at that point. And again, based on the program as it exists today, this is no expectations of any changes. All right, so the most colorful graph in the slide deck looks at the different components of growth. So the green bar represents the status quo. This is, imagine that the same number of individuals with the same age and the same health needs was constant over 20 years. So that's just, that rectangle is just the base that we're starting off of. And then adding on recipients, there'll be a few more recipients in Medicaid, not a great number, but that gray sliver in there represents growth in recipients of Medicaid. The dark blue sliver represents growth in utilization intensity of Medicaid services. So individuals will use more service, a few more services, and the intensity of those services will increase over time. So, but not a great deal. The biggest impact on the program, and we've seen it in right now all sectors of society, quite honestly, is reimbursement rate growth. So rates paid to providers are going to increase, and that's going to be where the growth is in the program. It largely is not going to be from more recipients. It is not going to be from much greater utilization. It's going to be from paying providers. So. Okay, so then looking at this a little bit different way, this shows the same four. The green represents the same four that I just showed, but now the gray on top of that represents the additional spending that would happen if reimbursement rates increase at the same rate as medical price inflation. So even though my expectation is reimbursement rates are going to be growing much faster than they did, say, between 2010 and 2022, they're still going to grow. There's still efforts. There's still the power by the state to keep this from going too fast. And so expectations will still grow slower than medical price inflation. And that's important. It doesn't look like a lot, but by 2045, if reimbursement rates grew at the same rate as medical price inflation, that'd be nearly another $800 million of spending by the state. And so there is still a lot of benefit in negotiations and the efforts by the department to maintain rates that are, end up being a little lower than medical price inflation. Okay, so last section here. Let's talk about chronic conditions and the Medicaid program. In the Medicaid program, and this is not unique to Alaska Medicaid. This is not unique to Alaska. This is happening across the country, and it's probably in healthcare around the world. Its spending is really driven by a relatively small number of recipients, Medicaid recipients. And so just going from left to right, 1% of Medicaid recipients account for 22% of spending on Medicaid services. And 5% represent 52% of spending. And just kind of keeps on going across that the 10% accounts for 2/3 of spending on Medicaid services. And then just the last one is the 50% of Medicaid recipients, and again, not enrollees, just recipients, the 50% of recipients with the lowest spending account for only 4% of spending. And so, again, the population change matters a lot. The reimbursement, the growth and reimbursement rates matter a lot. And even to the point that there's a number of reasons for these, and I talk about this in the report. The individuals that are the most expensive, not only are they the most expensive, and on a dollar sense, their growth in spending grows faster. On a percentage base, it grows much faster also. And this gets back to an issue of those that are expensive end up, those with chronic conditions tend to be more expensive. They add another chronic condition. It compounds those costs, as well as treatments and such, novel treatments and stuff for conditions end up being very expensive. So a small subset the most expensive, those individuals, their growth in spending tends to be much faster also. And unfortunately, this is a tough thing to deal with. There's across the board, it isn't a one-size-fits-all type of issue of like, oh, how do we fix this? There's a lot of different conditions in there that lead to these high costs. Okay, let's now cross that with, or let's start talking about the chronic conditions part of it. Is pretty well known that the likelihood or the preponderance of chronic conditions increases with age. There's relatively few young people with chronic conditions, but there definitely are. And so you see, again, going from left to right by different age groups, under 15 individuals, recipients under 18, excuse me, under 15, the vast majority of them have no diagnosed chronic conditions, but some still do. And as you move across, the proportion of recipients with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions is increasing over time, or is increasing with age. And one thing I think is really is kind of interesting, and maybe this is somewhat nuanced. It isn't age that does it. It isn't age does not make the individual more expensive. It's the chronic condition. And so, and I think I have it in the report this year also, an individual who is 15 years old and has no chronic condition costs about the same as a 35-year-old with no chronic condition. It costs about the same as a 45-year-old or an 80-year-old with no chronic conditions. The issue is the 80-year-old is much more likely to have one or more chronic conditions than the 15-year-old and such. So, again, it isn't age. It's that the chronic conditions. So the extent that the preventable chronic conditions can be prevented, it definitely would impact, positively impact, the program. And let's look at this like a little more intensely. So in this case, we're looking at across the horizontal axis is number of diagnosed chronic conditions. The bar on the far left are individual or recipients with zero chronic conditions, which represents the majority of Medicaid recipients. So most Medicaid recipients do not have any diagnosed chronic conditions. Their average spending is about $4,500 per year, they were $4,500 in 2024. And then as we go across, the number of recipients diagnosed with one chronic condition, two, three, four, and as you go across. And as you expect, as each additional chronic condition is added in there, spending per recipient increases greatly and has a kind of outsized effect on the Medicaid program. And even the fact that in a program in 2024 that was about $2.7 billion, the majority of recipients had no diagnosed chronic condition, and their total spending was less than $500 million, so a relatively small portion of the total spending. And just to, again, look at just a handful of chronic conditions, and this is looking at the individuals in the Medicaid program. In green bars represent the 10% of recipients that are the most expensive with the cost of services, and the gray represents everybody else. And so just pulling out a few of these, the tobacco use, the proportion of recipients that are the most expensive, those that are have a diagnosed chronic condition. Those chronic conditions go beyond simply diseases. It's also conditions, tobacco use, alcohol, drug abuse, and such. So it's deeper than just simply a disease. But tobacco use is far more prevalent among the most expensive, as well as mental health condition, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and such. And so the it's, again, no great secret that chronic conditions lead to higher costs, but it's marketable how just the extent to which individuals with those with the chronic conditions, how they're going to be the most expensive. Okay, so I think we're just about through here. The this figure, so this slide 27, we're looking at the forecast again. So we're right back to our forecast from 2025 to 2045, in a total forecast of $7.4 billion. In this case, the green part of each of those bars represents recipients who will not have a, you know, without a diagnosed chronic condition, and the gray represents recipients with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. In 2025, 81% of spending on the Medicaid program was for the individuals with one or more diagnosed chronic conditions. That's going to grow over time, largely or primarily due to the aging of the population. And again, it's not the age that results in chronic conditions. It's the fact that older people have the more probability to have a chronic condition just because they've been living longer. But that's going to increase over time, and so that by 2045, 84% of the spending on this program is going to be by recipients with one or more chronic conditions. So, right, let's see, was that it? Yep, that was it right there.
So. Thank you for that presentation. Does any member of the Finance Committee have questions? Senator Kaufman.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the divergence between enrolled and services, it just got me wondering around our controls, our prevention of, do we know that everybody who enrolls is a real person and they're receiving real services? Do we have adequate fraud, you know, waste, abuse type controls to assure that somehow these services that are delivered are being delivered to real people?
So, Senator Kaufman, through the chair, there is a group within the state that does that work, and I can't really speak to that. I'm analyzing data that's within the MMIS, the Medicaid Management Information System, and so my assumption is this is all legitimate, and there is a fraud and waste, fraud and abuse, a fraud and waste, I guess, group that works, that is always doing this work. So I don't have I'm not involved with that at all. So, yeah.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I can appreciate, you know, you're not involved with that, but I think it would be interesting to know, as we're looking at trends, kind of the reality check within those numbers. Right. And then if I may follow up, please.
Please.
So are there any like macro trends other than just simple inflation in the state that are at risk of driving up the cost of delivery? I know there's opportunities, maybe telehealth type opportunities to drive it down, but are there any other trends other than the recipient's condition or age, anything like a macro trend in the state that may prevent a future cost risk?
So, Senator Kaufman, through the chair, I look, you know, in my mind, and again, and I'm not an expert on the medical side of this, but it's the number of individuals with a treated or with a diagnosed behavioral health or substance abuse condition has increased quite a bit. So I see that as that you know, so there's the question earlier about the changes in the at the federal level in the program risk, which there's certainly there for the Alaska population, and this has also happened in many other states and stuff, especially on the West Coast. Behavioral health and number of individuals on the program that have a behavioral health diagnosis has grown a lot, and the number of individuals with a diagnosed substance abuse has increased a lot. They are very expensive to treat, and they not only are utilizing those behavioral health services, they're also far more likely to be going to the emergency room multiple times in a year, and to be using, to have inpatient hospital services, and on and on. So that traditional, they're not only more likely to use behavioral health, they're also more likely to be using what many of us regard as like the traditional ambulatory health also. So that's, to me, that's a big risk for the Medicaid population in Alaska and definitely elsewhere too.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. So I guess that's kind of the supply side or the demand side risk. And then over on the supply side, are there any changes there that we need to be aware of?
So Senator Kaufman, through the chair, that's not an area that I've focused on, so I don't know those answers. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Do you have any closing comments, Mr. Helbig?
I don't, just thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. So,
thank you. That concludes today's meeting. There will be a meeting tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We have four bills for introduction. Senate Bill 80, Board Extensions, Senate Bill 109, Permanent Fund Dividend, POMV Split, Senate Bill 73, Marijuana Tax Registration and Income Tax, Senate Bill 113, Appropriation Taxable Income and Digital Businesses. With that, we are adjourned.